All right, Chichos, I need you to listen carefully to this list and see if any of these describe you. You have been in therapy for years, or you have been in 12-step recovery for years, but all of your healing has been in your head and not in your body. You live in a constant state of hypervigilance. You are constantly waiting for the other shoe to drop. You have 3 good days in a row, you're bracing for impact, or perhaps you just can't enjoy any of the good things in your life. Feeling good feels so unsafe. Or perhaps you are totally disconnected from your body. You are numb. You're checked out when somebody asks you how you're feeling. You don't know how to answer. You are stuck in self-sabotage, procrastination, self-doubt, and no matter what you do, you stay stuck in it. You cannot be alone with yourself, so you scroll, you eat, you stay busy, you do anything not to feel. Your inner critic is absolutely relentless, and after a lifetime of hearing it, you can't even identify it as being your inner critic. It just feels like who you are. You are currently doing IFS therapy or parts work, and self is more of a concept that you understand rather than something that you actually can feel. Or perhaps you've been doing this healing work all by yourself, and somewhere in you, you know that healing and community is the piece that's been missing. So if you heard yourself in any of that, and who are we kidding, folks? I know that at least one of those things described you, okay? I have a message for you. I built a course. This is the first one that I built entirely myself, and it is everything that has actually worked for me. All of the stuff that moved the needle after doing years and years and years of therapy and realizing, holy shit, I'm not as healed as I thought I was. This is nervous system work. This is somatic parts work. This is actually learning how to be in your body instead of just knowing that you should be. I put it all together in 1 7-week live journey, and I am not teaching this from the top of the mountain as somebody who is perfectly healed. I am in the middle of this work just like you, and I built this thing because I needed it and nobody had put it together in this specific way for people like us. It is called Safe Within, a somatic healing journey to finding self-energy, and it starts July 1st. Early bird pricing runs through June 10th, so you, the person who is currently coming up with all the reasons why you shouldn't sign up, or you, the person who feels that little pit in their stomach right now telling them to sign up, or you, who doesn't feel anything in their body right now because they're so checked out, but whose head is telling them, I think I need to do this. Let's do the damn thing already. Go to adultchildpodcast.com/safewithin, adultchildpodcast.com/safewithin. You can find all the details. Do it now. A wounded inner child will never give up on a bad relationship's potential. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. What you're holding on to, just let it all go. What's making you slow now, just let it all go. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shitshows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shitshow, and I am an adult child. And if this is the first time you're hearing this term and you're wondering, like, what the hell does that mean? No, it does not mean that you are a child trapped in an adult's body. This is a term that is used for somebody who grew up in an alcoholic or dysfunctional family whose wounds have a way of falling them into adulthood and quietly running the show, or loudly running the show, whether that's in your relationships, in your reactions, in your careers, the thoughts in your head, in your body, pretty much anywhere and everywhere this can show up. And this is the podcast where we talk about what the hell to do about that. We curse here. We curse here. You've been born. Welcome aboard this hot mess of a healing ship. So apologies for the delay in getting this episode out to you. And what I'm about to share, I'm sharing just because I know that there's somebody listening who needs to hear this. Somebody who needs to give themselves some kind of permission today, who needs to give themselves a damn break. So I had 3 days in a row where I was just like really, really low energy. And it was kind of weird. Like I had 2 days in a row where I woke up in the morning and I woke up in the middle of like deep REM sleep. You know, that feeling when you wake up out of a deep sleep and you're just like absolutely exhausted, even though you slept. And then it just takes you forever to finally wake up. Well, I had that for 2 days in a row and I just like never woke up. So I had 2 days that were just a complete wash where I just didn't get much done. And then yesterday I woke up with just a list of stuff that I needed to get done. And I also had plans to go to the Chicago concert last night. And I'll tell you more about the concert in a second. But at the start of yesterday, I just told myself, you know, I'm going to just get done whatever I'm able to get done today. You know, whatever doesn't get done, it doesn't get done. If the episode goes out late, then it goes out late. You know, and I'm going to go to the concert regardless. And I'm going to grab food before the concert regardless. You know, the stuff that I had planned that I was actually looking forward to wasn't going to be something that I sacrificed. And so I'm just sharing all this because in the past, you know, I would have shamed the shit out of myself for this. I would have woken up this morning in a ton of anxiety and a ton of shame, you know, like treating a late episode like it was some sort of cardinal sin, like I was failing you all. And none of that was present for me this morning, like none of it at all. And so I'm just saying that out loud for anybody who needed to hear that, right? It's okay to give yourself a break. It's okay if you're a little late in getting something done. It's okay if, you know, things don't go to plan, if your energy's off for a few days, if you don't get to what you meant to get to. And it's okay to still do the fun thing you had planned. You do not need to cancel the fun thing just because you didn't finish the other things. So I went to the Chicago concert last night. And I gotta say, folks, pretty so-so. It was pretty so-so. You know, I'm a big Chicago fan. I don't think that there's many surviving members left. And not impressed, folks, not impressed at all. It was just kind of weird. I don't really know even how to describe it. And then what do we think about this? Okay, there was a 20-minute intermission. A 20-minute intermission. Now, I have seen all of the greats. I've seen The Who, Steely Dan, Doobie Brothers, Billy Joel, Elton John. Not a single one of them has ever taken an intermission, let alone a 20-minute intermission? A 20-minute? What do you need 20 minutes for? I also feel like, you know, maybe that's something you should disclose beforehand. like maybe that's something you should tell people beforehand. Maybe I would have made a different decision had I known that there was going to be a 20-minute intermission. And then also, too, I can't believe I'm sharing this. So I don't know. The guy that was like filling in for their lead singer, I don't know who this guy was, but I'm not kidding you. Like spitting, he looked like a very emaciated, sickly, like distant relative of Frankenstein. He did. I, of course, I had to share this with like the other random concert goers. I'll tell you this much. None of them thought it was as funny as me, but none of them disagreed. They all thought that it looked like a distant relative of Frankenstein. Oh, okay. Let's just move it along here. So today, folks, we are diving deep with fan fave, returning guest. You know him, you love him, Patrick Tian. Psychotherapist, YouTube creator, and we're getting into just a whole bunch of topics today. I'm talking a lot about relationships. This is just a conversation that goes all over the place. It flows. It's natural. I don't really need to tell you any more about it. Let's just get on with the damn show, shall we? But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show, my online support community where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. This is a support system at your fingertips, in your back pocket, available to you either through an app on your phone or on the computer. We have a 24/7 hour chat. This is a support community with a personality, with a sense of humor. We laugh, we cry, we do it all. I promise that you will feel right at home a lot faster than you think. This is relational trauma, folks, and we heal relational trauma through safe relationships. And this is the place where you can do so for less than a damn dollar a day. So you, yes, you, The person that's been wanting to join for forever. Let's just do it already, okay? Quit the crap. Damn the join. Send the link in the show notes. Next, give me a follow on Insta, on TikTok, at AdultChodPod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, 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 give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, well, he needs no introduction. We all know who you are. Mr. Patrick Ian, welcome back to the pod.
Hello.
Another fellow shit show, recovering shit show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm DMing you.
Yep.
Okay, so this is where I want to start. That's what I call myself. That's what my community is called, Patrick. It's called the shit show.
Mm-hmm.
So
I get it.
That's a good filter, right? Because you have to have a certain personality type to be willing to join a community called the shit show, right?
Yeah, it's so funny. We're, you know, like, I kind of unrelated. I don't want to take this, like, okay, because I want to get back to what
Go
you were sort
it.
Of saying, like, where I get a lot of messages. There's a weird thing in social media that, and it irks you or it vexes you. It kind of burns you in a way, like, where you get feedback from people who the feedback makes you curious about why they were following you to begin with. Like, in the past 6 months, I've become more out there with my political views. And whether it's that or even back in the day when I would swear in my videos or swear here, there would be people that are just like, sort of like, how dare you? Swearing is very triggering for me. Unfollow. And I think in a way, I don't know why I'm getting on this, is someone in a way, like, I posted something and it's just like, kind of like, how dare you post that political issue that's happening right now. And I think people lose sight of it. It's just like, hey, you know, some stuff isn't for you. You can move on. You can just, it's not for you, or you're not who I thought you were. There's people have such an expectation that I'm following you for the content and it has to be exactly the way I want it. So it just kind of made me think about that, like, in a way, like, I'm from Boston. I swear. I get it. I'm swearing less just because it's just, you know, like, whatever. I think that people maybe look to my content and maybe they're expecting somebody with, like, a blazer and shoulder pads of an academic, and I'm talking about childhood trauma.
Little handkerchief.
Yeah, or something like that. And that's specifically what I've avoided in my content, because it's not
who you are.
It's not who I am. Right.
I get that with the swearing too. You know, people are like, I wish I could listen to your podcast. And it's like, that's not what this healing is about, right? It's about becoming our authentic selves. And I'm somebody that curses. Like, I'm sarcastic, I'm dry. And I've had somebody say to me, I need to change my sense of humor so that I'm speaking to all adult children.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
I said, this is like my personality. I lead with it in the front. I say, I'm not everyone's cup of tea. This might be for you, but might not be for you. So one thing I've had to learn how to do is not apologizing for who I am.
Yes. To sort of say, yes, I could see how if you grew up in a very verbally abusive home, I can totally see how swearing is a trigger for you. But I love what you just sort of said, because I think all of us can relate to it in the way that as childhood trauma survivors, we make moral issues out of everything. Because we're growing up in such amoral environments. Like, how could you swear and not know that that would trigger a whole bunch of childhood trauma survivors? How could you talk about your politics when you're alienating so many people who maybe need your care? Like, there's such a self-righteousness to childhood trauma that I lived in forever. You know, whether that's like, how could you walk so slow when I'm walking behind you? It's like, as an incredibly impatient, probably crazy person. So I think that I would love to see childhood trauma survivors, and I'm probably going to trigger anyone listening out there, we really need to take ourselves so much less seriously. You know, like, it's just sort of like, you know, that person's swearing, you don't like swearing. There's a lot of recovery that I had to learn, that people are massively different. But that is the way that's actually the nature, I think, of being triggered, is you were triggered to a moral issue. How could you talk over me? How could you not? And a lot of those moral issues are valid in some ways, But at the same time, too, we bring in this projection of amoral people.
What do you think, though, it's blocking people from seeing in themselves?
I personally didn't see how perfectionistic my moral triggers would make me, how self-righteous those triggers would make me, how disconnecting I would be with people, how I would have some higher ground than you because you weren't aware of the thing. And it's really an interesting conversation because I'm getting so sick of social media in the way that moral issues are becoming entertainment or have been entertainment for a long time. You know what I mean? Like, and some issues do need to be canceled and some people are not, you know what I mean? Like it's, some of it's just like, if we were all in the same room together, we'd be like, dude, what are you doing with that message or whatever? So, but when we think about it, like I opened up Threads this morning and it was someone saying something batshit. It was like an estranged parent. And they were talking about good on the mothers who are great mothers out there. My kids don't talk to me. They haven't talked to me in 5 years. And I'm opening up the app and it's kind of ugly on both sides. Like the estranged parents that are commenting, they're kind of outing themselves in a very weird way that it's clear why maybe your children don't talk to you. But then it's also ugly in the way that other people are triggered to the amorality about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know about, I would love to, maybe that would be a nice kind of conversation about where social media is just a place to kind of argue or spell out these moral issues or something like that.
Okay. So when was a moment in your healing where it was something that you thought that you had worked through and reared its ugly head and wrecked you?
Marriage. Many times there's like a cycle of that, I think, that it keeps popping up, around, this is specifically around 9/11. I had just finished, the biggest chunk of my first and biggest chunk of work, which was like a 4-year childhood trauma group, a relationship recovery process group. That's the work that I, educate about now. And when I was in private practice, those are the groups that I ran. So I started that group when I was 20 and I graduated around 23 or 24. And then it was amazing. That was life-changing work. I was a totally different person. But I was kind of in a pink cloud kind of place. I thought I had really, you know what I mean? And then I started dating and that was hit or miss. But I think that it's really the intimacy in dating that continues to show us places that need attention. Because in that relationship, it was about a 9 or 10th month relationship that I was on top of the world, gonna, you know, get a girlfriend, look at a marriage, start a family, that kind of a thing. And it was in that relationship that I was had buttons pushed that I didn't know I had. And I was son of a bitch. Do you know what I mean? Like that was, I thought it was, you know, and it took me a good year and a half, 2 years after that relationship to figure out my, you know, figure out the buttons that got pushed, figure out some.
What
some
were
piece.
They?
An old button of, and I'm sure that this is the truth for many different genders, but like sort of when flat out, this happens for a lot of men, the trigger around a woman not seeing you're good and constantly telling that you're a fuck up and bad. You know what I mean? Or because of her issues or because of relationships, you know, like sort of like I was, you know, a young guy, but really consider myself a good guy at that time. I was an earnest boyfriend. There was, you know, like nothing kind of going on. But like, I think we've all been with somebody that is constantly projecting, you're bad, you're let me down, you were thoughtless, you were oblivious, you did this again, you did that again. When I think I went into that relationship perfect from now on, it's a new day, it's a new beginning, you know what I mean? Kind of a thing. So, but with that relationship, it just hit buttons that I didn't really know about. And then years later, Getting married and now being in a really like intimate long-term relationship in that way, that's always going to show people more kind of wounded places. But I think it's almost like a good conversation to think about what can we expect from the type of therapy work that we do, where my mentor would kind of say that like it's very difficult, hard work to do childhood trauma work. But that work just really brought me up to sea level with everybody else. It made me more human, as opposed to feeling like I was drowning all the time. So even in that relationship that I discussed was really, really hard and triggering and buttons, is I was also in a very different place in it, that I was much more in it, that it was still progress, where it was a 10 month relationship, where my relationships prior to treatment wouldn't last more than 2 months, because I was such a mess. So there was progress in there, but it's a lot like therapy work kind of maybe brings us to a neutral human place. And then there's just human stuff that happens to us afterward. And that is peeling of the onion and figuring out relationships and figuring out intimacy, you know, because that's like when we look at the Gottmans, we're probably looking at a couple who has been together for at least 3 or 4 decades and have really gone through what most of us kind of go through with intimacy, triggers, figuring each other out, how to be a better partner, how to really listen. So it doesn't feel good, but these relationship bumps and failures are in many ways kind of normal, you know?
So I was recently having a conversation with a friend about a dynamic that I'm curious if you've come across it. Well, I'm sure you've come across it before. And that is where one person in a relationship is doing this childhood trauma healing, and the other partner is not, and is impatient with the process. You've been doing therapy for over a year. Like, why aren't you better yet? Like, why are you still in therapy? And so I'm just curious if you could speak to that, to like what's actually going on with this partner, the partner who's impatient with the process. And I'm also curious too, like what your perspective is as far as like the experience of the person who's doing the work, like what it is that they're up against.
Oh, yes. That is, that would frustrate me as well. It's like a very kind of pedestrian understanding of therapy. Do you know what I mean? It's a very like, it's kind of scary in the ways that a lot of the general public out there might think mental health is almost like the treatment of diabetes. You go get it diagnosed, you know what I mean? Maybe you get a medication, maybe you change your diet, bippity boppity boo, you're in good shape. You know what I mean? Like, no, you can't eat Oreos all the time anymore. But like, it's like they have a very like transactional concept. The worst phone call I've ever gotten as a therapist was someone called me as a consult and sort of said, "I struggle with sex addiction. Do you think you can clear that up in 10 minutes, in 10 sessions?" And I was so offended. I was so, because it's so concrete and transactional. There's no process at all in that. So, and we can I mean, it's like, and again, not to demonize anybody, but someone in a relationship with someone struggling with childhood trauma is, it would be, you know, it'd be better if, you know, sort of also to ask, well, what about you? Can you go to therapy and get some guidance in your relationship and maybe look at, do you know what I mean? Why might you be kind of transactional about it? Why might you, do you know what I mean? Or do you maybe fawn? Because again, childhood trauma survivors, we can be self-righteous. We can really, you know, not all of us, some of us are incredibly fawning, which is like a different type of problem. But some of us can really, you know, it's just the math of relationships. We will put our stuff on our partners no matter what. Do you know what I mean? And maybe for that person who's like, why aren't you better yet? That might be its own projection of parental stuff. I would be wondering about, like, who taught you to be that kind of transactional? Who taught you that emotions or problems are so easily fixed? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, I would be wondering if that person grew up in a very kind of anti-emotional household, which is his own. And that's usually what I would see when I would treat couples like that, when the other person would be like, well, I just don't get it. Why aren't you better? Like, I don't see what's so bad about your mom. I'm sitting there as a therapist, kind of going, I wonder where you learned to be that out of touch with the humanity going on around you.
Yeah, I would think it would be a family that very much about appearances too,
Right.
looking good from the
Yeah.
outside.
Performative families. The other side to this issue is that for the childhood trauma survivor who's paired with the person who's like, I don't understand. I don't know why therapy isn't going faster. The other side of that is usually the childhood trauma survivor is projecting a parental figure onto that person. And for the person who's a little bit out to lunch, they might be getting a lot of like, why don't you get this? Why don't you see me? Why don't you see that I struggle? Why do you? And that because that childhood trauma survivor may not be in tune with how much they're projecting or not working on their family system of origin, that it's kind of like a peanut butter chocolate problem. You know what I mean? I'm out of tune with my emotions and my own family stuff or whatever. And then the childhood trauma survivor or the identified patient is like, I'm again paired with someone that I have to fight to get to see me. But I've had clients who had an abusive partner who didn't like the result of therapy. And that result of therapy might have been better boundaries or better vocalization of issues or some pushback. Where, you know what I mean? Like in terms of like the abusive partner may have had this expectation that therapy was going to make them more compliant when therapy made them more authentic. I think when you start working on yourself, this is maybe the best way to describe it. When I was going through treatment, like many other childhood trauma survivors, I wanted to assimilate in the rest of the population and just be normal. I just wanted to be normal like everybody else, where I wasn't freaking out all the time or going into shame holes or struggling with drugs and alcohol, all this stuff. I just wanted to be normal. And then when I started really doing this work and changing is I didn't really like normal people. I liked authentic people. You know, I liked people in 12-step programs and people who were going to therapy. But my expectation was in the beginning was I just wanted to be like functional, normal, looking good, not such a mess. When at the end result is sort of like, I need people around me to be working through things. I really need people in my life to be on some kind of path and on some kind of trajectory. Not all the time, because that's like exhausting. But the worst thing you could do is put me with another dad in his garage, doing traditional male chit chat conversations. Do you know what I mean? I don't, you know, like I would, I'm just that kind of person where it's like after a few minutes, I'm like, oh, tell me about your dad, you
Yeah,
know,
there's
or you
no
know what I mean?
depth.
Like, are does your kids trigger you in some specific, really unique way? You know, like sort of like, you know, not, and I'm not like monitoring them. I'm just, oh, excuse me. I would just be curious about their inner world
Of
when maybe the
course.
normals or the vanilla people out there or whatever. And again, I'm not trying to demonize or create like, you know, not everything has to be super heavy all the time, which is another problem, right? But yeah, I need that kind of thing in my life. So we would just, you know, I think once you kind of get the bug, maybe you don't, maybe you can't handle the superficial relationships or handle that friend who is maybe acting out and not aware of it. Or I definitely can't handle people that, a good sign of my recovery was I could no longer handle people who would snap at you and then make it okay a second later. You know, that's a good example where, you know what I mean? Like of chasing normalcy, thinking that that was normal, you know, but, people who rub me the wrong way are people who are extremely unconscious. It's kind of a fine balance between we can't do relationships where the person is maybe existing on some kind of superficial level, or maybe they're, you know, or maybe they're not. They're just like happy in their life. Like not everybody has to be go super deep into a deep dive. And
I can't stand people that are happy all the time. They drive me nuts.
Yeah, you know, but like, you know, it's almost like a spectrum in some ways. Like for people living in a happy superficial place, I'm not going to connect with, but I'm also not going to fully connect with someone that I constantly have to take care of who has no internal responsibility to the shit show of their emotions. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a balance to find somebody who is, you know what I mean? Like, aware of themselves in a good enough way and doing some work on themselves in a good enough way, you know, that, where when two people come together, that they can have good fights, good conflict, you know, and it's sort of, there's so much healing that comes in an intimate relationship. There's so much really, and I learned from my mentor in a good enough relationship, we're constantly waxing and waning of connection. And that's like a normal kind of thing. And it's the way that we need to connect with each other in the day-to-day and the week-to-week that brings us back to that. And also the coming to the other side of bumps and triggers and conflict is that strengthening of, you know, so it's, it, even though that it sounds super, super hard, but once it, once two people are really kind of working and investing in that, you know, but I will say this is that what doesn't go away is, as a human thing or a childhood trauma thing or whatever the thing is, we will always have this reserve in the back of our mind. It's like our inner child going, well, I don't know about you. I don't know about this. Maybe I'll go my own way. Maybe, you know what I mean? I don't know. I don't know about, you know, like that's, that's always something in the background that we don't always have to pay attention to unless we're in a shitty abusive relationship, you know? But I think it's always something that we'll reserve as a way to reserve some power or autonomy, you know.
You think so, even people with like a extreme anxious attachment have that?
No, that's a good point. Maybe I was vocalizing how maybe I'm wired, or people who are more in that
avoidant
way
or demoralized.
Yeah. Or well, I would also sort of say maybe not, because I when I started, I was anxious, preoccupied. And after that 4 years of group, I became different. I have this weird theory that we're kind of all over the road like a drunk driver through our recovery. You know, like for those who are typically, and I get it, like some people are just typically wired, anxious, preoccupied, but I wonder after some intense, deep work that they might be comfortable being alone for 2 or 3 years or something like that, or that kind of a thing. Or it's like, you know, what happens when an anxious, preoccupied person reclaims kind of an inner fuck you? You know what I mean? Because that's a possibility. That's a possibility too, you know?
Yeah. No, I think I've gotten to a place of insecure where before it was like, I don't know about you, but we're in it to win it, baby.
I know. I don't know about you, but I'm going to keep trying.
I do know about you and it's awful, but I'm staying, baby. This is horrible.
Right. It's really kind of a funny thing. Like there's, I wonder what's wrapped up in that. You know, is it losing time, losing face? Is it about trying to get somebody to wake up? Probably maybe all of it, you know, like why we're so invested in something.
Abandonment wounds. I mean, that's what it was for me. It would, you know, whenever that happened, that first trigger after a couple dates, I no longer was collecting information as to whether or not this was the right person for me. I was hooked.
Yeah. Yep. Yes, we can definitely get hooked. I think for me personally, that hook was really relevant to early, early stuff of trying to get my mother to wake up. So if I could
wake up, you know, in what way? Like to leave your father?
Yeah, all of it. Leave my father, get sober, be happier, be more of a mom. I think I was just talking with somebody the other day. Who was I talking to? About really as kids who are growing up with parents who are in distress or stressed out or dysregulated or unsafe or whatever. I think really little kids who are heart-based are trying to get that parent to be happier. For two reasons. Up front, it's like it's really unsafe for little people to be around unsafe parents. But then there's a secondary thing behind that is I think if we can get that person to be happier and okay with us and wake up, they might be a better parent to us. So I often even wonder if it maybe is a little bit of wrapped up in survival. Do you know what I mean? So it's like people pleasing or fawning or trying to get somebody to see our goodness or just keep going with something we know is bad is, I think there's so much that can be kind of pulled out from that, but it really comes down to a person's individual story, you know? Because some of us might have had a parent that we didn't try really hard with because we were just so, it was so not safe to keep trying, you know?
Yeah, what woke my mom up, and it was only temporarily, but was when I started acting out.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that dried her out for a period of time.
From her drink, from her drinking, her own drinking?
Yeah, when I when I was acting out from 12 to 19.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that last time we spoke, which, And good for her. Was that a positive thing? And,
no.
You know, no, it wasn't. Yeah.
No, Patrick, it's been horrible. It's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
The past 17 years, but especially over the past, once I started healing, like the past 10 years has really just been a downward spiral for both of them. It's been horrible. It's been really horrible. So.
Yeah. Wow. Because she tried to wake up, but like what?
Well,
what
I mean, she didn't wake up. I mean, she just because they're I mean, they just, it's like I was the problem. Right. And then that kind of was distracting them. But then once I got sober, they just picked up, you know, they just picked up where they left off.
Yes, I got you. Right. Yeah. Like they just noticed something and that's it, that you were acting out.
Yeah, I mean, I was getting sent to rehabs and boarding. So, I mean, there was a lot of energy that was going into it, you know? So yes. It was just all of the focus was on me.
Now it's coming back to me, right? Right. But what's really hard about that, and maybe coming back to these couples that we're speaking of, is, and for like little kids trying to get people to wake up, it's like really impacts us when we don't have an impact on the parent.
Mm. Oh, yeah, it's brutal.
And there was many times that I relate to your story in that way of my mom kind of seeing things or getting it or whatever, but she would always go back to drinking or go back to men or something like that. So there's a weird betrayal in all that. Like you, it's almost like when, that phrase when we say to each other, you were so close. You were so close to understanding this concept. And they just go back to doing what they do, you know?
Well, yeah, especially when like alcoholism has always been known. It's not like we've ever been in denial. We know what the deal is.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost like an extra layer of betrayal there because I think so many people's parents and families are in such deep denial. And that's what makes my experience so weird is like there's an element of denial, but there's also an element of like we're all in the know here.
Yeah. Doesn't that drive you crazy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just drives people crazy that it takes a long time, I think, to let go of that. Because on some level, we understand the alcoholism too. But I guess I love what you just sort of said, because it really makes me think about the family estrangement issue. in that reality is always something that's not fully tangible. Do you know what I mean? Like, in other words, sort of like the countless times that I really set a boundary with my mother around drinking or whatever, and that ultimately resulted in no contact. It's sort of on one hand, on the upper reality thing, it's sort of like, yes, I understand, no drinking, blah blah blah, but she would still do it anyway. But when you're there in the room with her, when she would still do it anyway, feels like reality's not tangible a little bit. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, son of a bitch, I just fucking said, like, we just went through this whole kind of a thing, like, related to your point about everyone knows it's alcoholism. Everybody knows. The neighbors know, the people in the meetings know, the people in the history, the people at the rehab, that social worker, blah 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 blah. Everybody knows. But yet you're still drinking Chablis at Thanksgiving if I come visit you. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of fucked up. And even if there isn't alcoholism in the family, that reality thing is still kind of the, everyone knows that there was a sexual assault in this family. You know what I mean? Like, it was even a dread. Everyone has the same script and we all know what kind of happened. But then, when Uncle Tim died, do you know what I mean? You still require me to sit with my grandmother or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's just like it's such a mind F.
Yeah, where everybody knows, but we pretend like nobody knows.
Yes. And one last thought in it is that the recovery piece and all that is, for many people, including myself, is just because reality doesn't feel tangible inside our family system of origin, we still need to reclaim it and decide for ourselves what it is and then make decisions based upon that. Do you know what I mean? Like, coming back to, like, when I opened up Threads this morning and there was this shit show of a family estrangement post with many likes, with many back and forths with all of it. Do you know what I mean? Like, there it is again, like, where someone is sort of saying, like, well, my son went no contact because we have political and religious differences. Even still reading that, there's like, oh, there's a very much untangible reality that is happening in this family system. Do you know what I mean? That, does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
You
Yeah, to
know?
make that's the issue at hand when it's
Right.
really just representative of something deeper.
And if that adult child saw their parents post, their inner child might be like, was it just political or religious differences? You know what I mean? Like, and we have to, for a while, we have to really come back to our truth and our reality, that that's a very light way to put it, of just political and religious differences. Do you know what I mean? Like, sort of like, and, you know, the religion or the politics probably became inhumane. You know?
I wanted to circle back to what you were speaking about with the good enough relationship. How does one distinguish between when a relationship is a good enough relationship, or this is somebody that is using that as a way to justify staying in a toxic relationship?
Good question. And, like, what's the difference between a good enough relationship and a person convincing themselves that they're in one? That is really, I think, on an individual. The person convincing themselves, probably really might still need to do some inner work around the magical thinking, like, we're coming back to maybe like the reality issue there of just trying, it's really confusing because it can go both ways. I've convinced myself that a relationship wasn't good enough when it actually was in the past because of my trauma, and I've also convinced myself the opposite because of my trauma. So it really came down to me looking at things like, what does this take me back to in childhood? Is it, if I'm operating on any kind of childhood trauma, just make it work no matter what, or rescue, or trying to get someone to see me, or whatever, I might be kind of in trouble. The other question that I learned from a really good AA sponsor is sort of, do I have any business being in this relationship? You know, and that could be things like, we might be dating beneath us at times. We might be dating in places where other people might get hurt around it. Do you know what I mean? Or something like that. So it's sort of like, and wounded inner children can complicate those ideas. Do you know what I mean? Like, but do I have any business in this relationship?
The answer for all mine was hard no. It was hard no.
Yeah. Can I ask maybe for what reasons? Do you know, like?
Oh, well, I mean, active alcoholics?
Yeah.
That's a hard no.
Yeah, I guess what I mean is like, what might have been the inner child reasons?
Oh, trying to save mom, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think it was a combination of the emotional unavailability of my dad coupled with the trying to save my mom in the relationships. Yeah. And relationships where it was very clear that the other person didn't think that we were in a relationship.
Say that again. They didn't know they were.
It wasn't like they really were acting like we were in one.
Right.
You know, and just like desperately holding on, like waiting for them to make that commitment.
Sure.
But too scared to say anything because I was afraid that would scare them off.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. I very much relate to everything you're kind of saying. Like, in a similar way, I was very determined to rescue my mom from herself in context of my dad who was abusive. So there, you know what I mean? Like, that's a very, really tricky kind of a thing. But for someone to, coming back to your question about sort of like when, I think you just answered that question of knowing that we really have to check ourselves from a place of like, what am I doing? Do you know? And really looking at sort of like, is there additional work to do around? And I know I probably exhaust people and frustrate people, especially people who have done a significant amount of work. Like, why do I have to keep talking about my fucking mom? You know, like, it's sort of, we keep talking about our mom if we're still acting on that setup of trying to get somebody to wake up. We were, you know, like another quote from my favorite quote from my mentor is looking at, we were set up to chase unavailable people. Do you know what I mean? Like, we were set up to try to make something impossible work. We were also set up to have really a very foreign concept of what healthy would look like. Mm. Do you know, like, where another thing that I'm guilty of and I see in many childhood trauma survivors is we have this biased lens where, let's just say you grew up in alcoholism, poverty, and chaos, that you're dating somebody who is like, they're an accountant and they have a clean apartment and they feed their pets. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not, it sounds goofy, like no one's really that sort of naive, but the inner child is thinking like that. And when that's running us, we're not catching that that person is weirdly secretive or subtly critical. Or it's a once, it's not reciprocal when we talk about emotions. And there, you know what I mean? Like, or.
Yeah, that was me. It's very much like looking at their resume and disregarding all of their behavior.
Yeah. That's a better way to put it. Mm-hmm. That's a really good way to put it. Yeah. You know, and I think when we're dating and we're, you know, it's sort of, and I think this is a bit human. It's not all like we're totally limited childhood trauma survivors, but like I think that where childhood trauma survivors are less likely to be protective of themselves and take things slow and to be kind of thoughtful. Do you know what I mean? Like, that was not me at all. I would rush into things and not be, do you know what I mean? Like, at that relationship I told you that lasted 10 months that I was just got out of, like, this long-term childhood trauma treatment, I'm like 24. I probably could have known in the first 2 weeks what I realized 10 months later after a lot of accusations and being the bad guy and just, you know, not being treated well. And yeah.
So changing topics, I was watching one of your recent YouTube videos, the one that you did on self-blame and self-hate. And I thought that you did a really excellent job of illustrating just why it's so much easier for a kid to land on there's something wrong with me, like I'm broken, instead of my parents are the problem or my parents are dangerous.
We'll start to do that because we're too young to know that we're not safe. You know what I mean? So it's like in other words, self, you know, in a way that, you know, a 10-year-old doesn't know that dad's a narcissist and mom's an alcoholic fully. They have feelings about that. But the self-hate is almost something like, and self-blame is sort of like, I'm not lovable enough for them to change. That's one thing. The other thing is sort of, it's like hating yourself because you have one set of reality and the family has another one.
Can you speak to that more?
It's a tricky thing. So if you're feeling like there's something wrong with me, let's just say someone is growing up in an anti-love house that is violent, that the worst thing you could do in this home is to be vulnerable or weak. There's sarcasm. There's a lot of making fun of each other. And you're like a highly sensitive, heart-based kid. We will start to hate that quality about ourselves and start to hate that reality because it never works and it makes ourselves a target. Do you know what I mean? So in other words, it's kind of like, I think kids, when the adults aren't being honest about what is kind of going on and there's wrapped up in other kind of stuff, we will start to self-sabotage. We will start to act out because, like, what's the point of anything? Do you know what I mean? Like, what's the point of, it's like where it's almost like the behavior of a hostage. We get bitter. Do you know what I mean? We start to like, well, what's the point of eating? Do you know what I mean? Like, what's the point of like anything if you're not gonna let me go or even agree that you're the fucking bad guy in this, you know? So
yeah, that's really interesting. Do you feel like all self-sabotage includes an element of self-hatred?
No, not always. It can just come from different places. I think a lot of it is the inner child not knowing how to fully, let's just say someone is at a job and there's a new, they've been there for 10 years. They know they're very capable. They know everything, but they have childhood trauma where they feel they don't have much self-worth. You know what I mean? So that person never takes it in that they know where everything exists on the share drive. They know how the events work. They know everything. They know everybody's jobs, but they don't know that to be true within themselves. Like, they're very capable and good at what they do, but their inner child is just like, I'm just terrible and everyone's smarter than me, you know? It's like a very common thing for childhood trauma. The self-sabotage there, it, you know, sometimes they will not go for it. The self-sabotage could be around other people are better in this specific one. Sometimes self-sabotage is around the inner child messing something up in hopes that someone will notice and help them. Do you know what I mean? Like, the inner children can continuously test, you know, it's a very, very deep self, you know, subconscious kind of a thing, you know, like, like someone might do that in relationships and continue to pick fights or act out or whatever, and self-sabotage a good relationship because they're seeking some kind of intervention that they didn't receive.
Yeah. Or is it just a nervous system that's used to the chaos, right? Like the fear feels safer than feeling safe.
Could be simple as like anxiety. Do you know what I mean? Self-sabotaging. So like, because it's familiar to end up in a place of being the fuck up. And that feels maybe more, I'm not judging or blaming, but there's many different angles in my mind about how self-sabotage could happen. And I think it comes down to the individual. I would self-sabotage.
How did it show up for you? Yeah.
Yeah. I think I would self-sabotage in relationships and jobs because of the narrative that my parents had around me, that I would be the laborer, that I would, you know, my father said, you should work with your hands. not a lot of common sense. Likeable, but not a lot of common sense. Do you know what I mean? Just kind of like, I had a sibling who was like the valedictorian, and I was like the pot smoking kid playing in a Guns N' Roses cover band. Do you know what I mean? So there was like the sabotage was about always like water finding its path back to this lowly place that I was familiar with. So that's just one version of self-sabotage, you know, and sort of, yeah.
What was the hardest part of working through that?
The hardest part of working through that was realizing the grief of my parents not encouraging better for me around that. Of not, you know what I mean? The grief around like what you know what I mean? Like where like some there are just some parents out there that like, oh, don't go to school. It's just like a bunch of waste of time and money. You know what I mean? Like work for your uncle's landscaping factory and drink a 12-pack of beer every 2 days, like the rest of us. Do you know what I mean? Like you could see that in families playing out in that way where on what I see now is that why doesn't a family want better for the other generations? You know, and that's not that happens. It's not super, it's not the only way that families kind of do that, but there are very much it's kind of like being raised by miserable parents who might be intimidated if their parents, if their children surpass
Do or do
them.
better than them.
Yeah. And it's also the parent gets to have their child in a similar place with them. And they can bond around that. You know, they can bond. Yeah, you know, like, look at those educated assholes over there living their better lives. We know better, right?
So what are you working on? Got anything exciting coming up?
Yes, I in the middle of writing a book. I'm pretty
Yes.
much you like sort of like.
You were last time too.
Yeah, it's been it's I've I shouldn't I like the book. It was just an ambitious kind of a book to write. So it's sort of like I'm nearly through my first draft and
Big deal.
yeah, I want it's a it's I'm talking about it's a book about those 4 years when I was in group therapy. So it's sort of like I'm doing it's a 3.5 year group therapy experience of people working on childhood trauma.
There was a lot of psychodrama in that, right?
Yeah, a lot. And sort of kind of introducing sort of the public to that work called RRP that we've also done some research. We've been in a research project for 3 years and we're about to publish our first paper on that. So we're
Oh,
trying
so
to.
what's the study? Or what was it on?
The study is I, from my mentor, I developed a 6-month modality of RRP where she created the long form group where I just created a shorter version of it so that people would be, they wouldn't have to be faced with such a long commitment. So they could do the 6 months, see if they like it, and continue in a longer form group if they chose to. But we started to ask permission if they, if for participants wanted to do clinical assessments that would measure progress through that 6 months. So we know the therapy works even under 6 months. And we've been busy sort of doing that empirical data and publishing it. We'll be publishing in a series this year of the relationship recovery process, which I'm really proud of and happy with. It's just been a long time coming, but kind of blessed in the way that we have the opportunity to do that study, to do that research. So yeah, those are two long-term goals going on, and
Are
then
you familiar with the term
yeah.
Tele?
No, what's that?
Tele is like something within you knows how to pick the right person to be playing a role in psychodrama. It's like an inner knowing of like you just like have a sense of like this person in the group is supposed to be the one that's playing your mom or your dad or something like that. Have you ever heard of this before?
No.
Do you have any stories about that? Do you have any
Yeah.
memories of?
I've been asked to be someone's abusive father or whatever. Sometimes in RRP, anybody can play those roles, but sometimes you want Jane to play your mom because Jane had an exact mom like you did, and you just think, you know what I mean? In that way, they're hard, but they're incredibly powerful work. But yeah, sometimes you have a gut reaction of who you want. Even in a way, it's this is in the book where someone is doing a court psychodrama where a perpetrator is being sentenced for sexually abusing another for one of the group members, a parent. And what I love about sort of that person was female and they chose two male group members to be like bailiffs. So from this place of, and anybody can play bailiffs, but they just wanted these two men who were very vocal around other abusive men to play those people who would be escorting the invisible parent out of the room, if that makes sense. So it's like if you the therapist is playing a judge, another group member is playing this person's lawyer, and then the bailiffs are the ones who are kind of keeping the perpetrator, who would be the parent, from acting out. Because in all this psychodrama, the inner child, it's like the inner child feels that it's real, even though it's not real. So the therapist might ask, what does it feel like to have your dad in the room right now? And that person might say, he's going to be charming and bullshit and be in total denial, and my mother's going to do the same thing as a pair of them. So then the therapist might say, well, these two bailiffs are going to prevent them from doing that. So you get to speak your truth. Yeah.
How long do you find it takes groups to warm up to feel comfortable in
Great
doing
question.
this role play?
Yeah. We don't do stuff like we would do smaller introduction role plays. And the book that I'm writing is kind of that chronological order of getting, you know, there's just traditional with groups is sort of a storming, norming, forming formula, where in the 6 month model, people share their stories, but there's not a lot of interpersonal conflict work. There's not a lot of role plays. Just to, because even in the long term work, we would be more sharing our stories, connecting over the issues first in sort of ways that aren't so in your face. So we might not do a rescue experiential. These are called experientials, these role plays. We might not do that until a year into the group. You know, we might not do a conflict resolution tool, call a 1-2-3, depending on the group, because some, it, you know, it's sort of sometimes there's a group that's just ready to go with that stuff in that way. And so there's a lot of people tends to be, you know, we're asking childhood trauma survivors to do conflict intimacy work when their trauma is around conflict and intimacy. So it takes a long time to build up safety, a container, trusting people, knowing each other's story in a good enough way. So it's not, we don't bust up with a heavy role play in the first month because that would just be too exposing for people, you know?
It's also nuts that you signed up for a group that was 2 years long, like that early on. Like that's like really big commitment.
It's so funny because it was the late 90s and it was actually a 3 year group. And speaking to what we started with, people had longer attention spans.
Yeah, no shit.
But in my case, I was 20 years old. I was waiting tables. I wasn't going to school. I was really lost. I was really stuck.
How did you find out about it?
That's the beginning of the book is a waiter friend of mine, a guy named David, just noticed how poorly I was doing. And he was in one of these groups with the therapist, Amanda. And he just sat down next to me. It was a beautiful, beautiful, rare moment where I actually opened up to somebody. But again, like coming back to what we said about people being on a path is David was, I could cry thinking about him. David was somebody who was going to like breath workshops and he was open about his childhood trauma. And I don't know if you've ever worked in a restaurant, but it's very intimate with people that if you're there for a long time, good and bad. But David was like this protective person. He would kind of watch out for you. He would protect you from the restaurant managers. And he was massively traumatized, but a wonderful guy. But he just noticed how poorly I was doing after a breakup. It was a breakup that hit me, made me hit bottom at 20, another like 6 week relationship. And I know that that's almost appropriate for a 20-year-old, but I was in a pattern of starting to date somebody and they would quickly see how much of a hot mess I was. And then they're like, I'm out of here. And, you know, I just opened up to him and I kind of said, I just feel like there's something wrong with me. Can't stop smoking pot. I can't, you know, get a relationship going. You know, like I was really telling him in as best as I could that I'm very numb. and things are catching up to me. And he just gave me Amanda's phone number on a piece of paper. And then, not to spoil the whole book, but like the best part was, like, for the first time in my life, I didn't just put it in my pocket and let it like sit there for 10 months. I just walked over to this payphone in this fish restaurant that I worked in with him. And then I left, I'm the therapist, a voicemail. And I was the first therapist and, you know, I ever called. Yeah.
How many people like stayed in the group the whole 3 years?
You're asking amazing questions related to everything. It's almost like you read the book. We all completed it, which was rare.
So how many in total?
8 group members, 4 men, 4 women. There were 2 gay people in that group. We were kind of diverse, you know, sort of like, and it's rare that 8 people start and 8 people finish. Usually 2 to 3 people might drop out and groups complete, you know, for good and bad reasons, you know. And that is actually the reason sort of why I was getting supervision from Amanda. And I asked her, like, what would it be like if I started a shorter model? Because in my own private practice, I started 2 long-term groups. And I explained to them, this would be a 3 to 3.5 year process. These were people who were on my individual caseload and were bonded to me and good enough, were doing therapy on childhood trauma. And my first group started as 8. And by the 6th month, I was down to 6 people, and then lost another one down the road, and then had to add people later. So I wanted to provide kind of a lower stakes version of this work where people can do a genogram and get the psychoeducation and just get the container of a group, because just being in the container of a group helps people get into their inner adult more. Mm-hmm. There's something magical about that. And I started to do these 6-month groups, and some people were like, that was great. I know more about my family history right now. I don't want to continue. And a lot of people would. So there'd be this kind of, you know what I mean? It had a shelf life to it that people could exit if they wanted to, if they either weren't interested or weren't ready. And we wouldn't have to find that out like 1.5 years into it.
Have you stayed in touch with any of the 7 other people that are in your group?
Yeah.
Yeah. You speak to them frequently?
Two specifically? Yeah. Like kind of like once a year. And they usually groups, like all human relationships, they can just kind of dissipate and out. But many of us stayed in, you know, one of the men in my group became a roommate, like a lovely guy who changed my life. You know what I mean? Like, this is sort of like that group ended, I think about maybe 8 months before 9/11, something like that. You know what I mean? And we were close for a while, but that was like 25 years ago, you know? So there's some people I've tried to get in touch with they don't have a digital footprint, and yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I was going to say, that would be so cool if you like had all of you got together.
A lot of Amanda's groups and my groups will continue relationships afterwards. Some even, the group will end, but they'll still meet up twice at the same group time or something like that. You know what I mean? But what bothers me a little bit about it is sort of sometimes where in the digital realm, it's interesting in a way that I was in private practice in a community around Boston. And then when COVID happened, everything went online. And at that time, the YouTube channel that I was doing kind of took off. So I start in COVID, I thought I would lose my private practice because people could not come in person and do that. But the opposite thing happened, where people who were just home and wanted to do work, I went from doing 2 or 3 groups a week to like 7, and then started to carry a wait list. But there's more access with online remote therapy, but you lose a little bit of something.
Intimacy.
I miss that. It's kind of hard to explain to somebody, like, so every week you would go in this room in Somerville, Massachusetts, and, you know, for 1.5 hours. And it's like, yeah, we would even go out for coffee. You know, it was a magical, magical experience, although it was very hard, hardest thing I ever did. But
Didn't you have an issue with, I feel like maybe you share that with, didn't you have like an issue with somebody in the group? You really didn't get along with them?
We all had issues with each other. So sort of like coming back to intimate romantic relationships, in an RRP group, someone will just flat out bug the shit out of you. They will just trigger you. It's always kind of happens. It's a therapeutic principle. I think Yalom calls it the recapitulation of family of origin dynamics or something like that. But there was and I talk about this in a book, there was a woman in that book who really struggled with men and just flat out didn't like them.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then that was my mother to a T. So there was a lot of amazing work that I kind of stood up to this woman one day. You know what I mean? And it was both, we had a good impact on each other in a way, even though that we weren't exactly close, you know?
Did they set a rule that no dating each other?
Yep. All those basic principles, you know what I mean? It's very different in the way that there's outside contact. Like we would go for coffee. It's like Amanda's model is about people really need a sense of community that is boundaried and reasonable enough. But yes, you can't date each other because that's incestuous, you know, because we're almost modeling a surrogate family, which mm-hmm. can freak people out in that way. But it's kind of like surrogate family and a good, healthy one, meaning that everything is talked about in the open. There are no secrets. Yeah.
Would you guys celebrate holidays together?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because I think in the middle of that, the start of that work, my first Thanksgiving after going no contact for the first time was with a band member. And I think the following one is like, we would have this like Land of Misfit Toys gatherings of family. You know what I mean? Like for those who, because some people in that group were in contact with family and that was okay and good enough. And some of us, it was like almost half and half.
Yeah. Last question. Who influenced Amanda the most in developing her model?
Judith Herman was one of them, but she had a really an amazing supervisor. She was working in substance abuse, mm-hmm. and she had this amazing supervisor that was like, she was sort of, that person was sort of saying, and this is the 90s, that man was sort of saying, some people can't get fully long-term sobriety until they look at their family stuff. And then Amanda was just probably like working through her own stuff and then started to chunk pieces together in this model. There was a lot of great stuff happening in the 90s. There was a lot of like very holistic retreats, people doing breath work, spiritual work, Reiki, like all kinds of stuff, you know, like I wonder if someone born around like the late 90s or something, but just like must like we remember the way we used to look at the 60s and we're just like, Jesus, you know what I mean? Like, because I even sort of, I saw this amazing documentary called 1975. And that was about the film industry and kind of where films went from spaghetti westerns to more a little bit almost independent, but big mm-hmm. production like Close Encounters or Jaws or All the President's Men or The Graduate mm-hmm. or stuff like that. They're really like powerful films. But in this documentary, they were talking about, there was kind of a mental health kind of craze that went around. And it was so funny because it was almost like there was this kind of young guru guy. And it was almost like the beginnings of that abusive AA quality of kind of like, sort of like, well, you just need to fucking shine your light and sort of not have expectations on your parents. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, your parents are human. It was like, you know what I mean? And people were really into it, but it was still with that kind of like, yeah, but you're still you. You're the problem. You gotta get out of your own way. So just thinking in the 90s, you know, we were like, whatever kind of, I had no concept of mental health in the 90s. I was just sort of a kid from the suburbs of Irish Boston who somehow one day was sitting across from a therapist and that changed my life, you know? So.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, yeah. I was born in 89, but I guess I still made it to therapy for the first time in like 98.
Yeah, what was that like? What was the therapy like? What was, you know, the vibe like?
I remember her name was Carol Bogdanoff.
Oh yeah, Carol.
Carol Bogdanoff. I don't really remember. I can remember The Office. I remember these stupid books we would read, but I wasn't against it, but I don't really know what the hell we were talking about. I remember she had braces.
I think with like working with kids, I wanted to work with kids, but I would have too much counter transference. Like if kids were being abused at home, my first internship was a family homeless shelter. So I would be seeing the children of parents who are trying to get sober, and most of those parents were domestic violence survivors and abusive themselves. So it was just it's not good when the therapist is so triggered by the issues. So like I would have way too much. I admire people who work with children, but the other side of that is sort of, it is tricky in a way because, if I sat down at the age of 10 with a therapist who was like, "So tell me what's going on at home," I'd be like, "No." Trying to get them to talk, absolutely not. You know what I mean? Like my dad's a little mean, but my mom is wonderful. You know what I mean? I had this like goofy, I really elevated and celebrated my mom, but my dad was the bad guy, and then therapy really had me take a look at that. But my dad being the bad guy was a consistent thing. But anyway, but just trying to get a child to talk about things, I get why they would want to do like play or narrative therapy or whatever they're kind of doing there. But on the other side of that is, I think kids are smart, and I would feel like I'm not five.
Exactly. Well, thanks for coming, Patrick.
Yeah, always a
We'll have you back
pleasure.
on in 2035 when your book comes out.
It's looking that way.
Thanks,
Yeah.
dude. Appreciate it.